Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome from Chicago. In this podcast, we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Mr. Eric Anderson. He is the client cyber evangelist, educator, and architect at Atlantic Data Security. Eric, thanks for your time and welcome to the show.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
All right, let's go ahead and get started. Tell us about your background, like how you got started in cybersecurity, what some of the highlights of your career, like what got you started in this field?
Oh, gee. Well, I've been in IT and tech longer than I can remember, well, longer than I can drive, which I'll date myself back to the 80s, starting in technology in general and IT, just having a knack for it and a passion for it. And then it was, again, started my career relatively early, part-time through high school and everything, and then continued. And then it was in the later 90s, company I was with, and I'd been doing consulting and support and coding or programming all that time, different things. And company I was with in the later 90s started to shift our focuses towards cybersecurity, early firewalls. And as you know, before the term cybersecurity really existed, we started, you know, identifying more of a need there. And we had a couple of individuals who were focused on firewalls and the demand was there. So I pivoted and we all started to pivot and really focused more on that specific area of tech. And it's been where I've been ever since for, like I said, a little over 25 years.
Okay. Well, that's a question I keep getting asked from time to time. When did the term cybersecurity actually evolve to the full force usage that it's being used today? What year do you remember that actually happened?
That's a great question, yeah. And I don't know.
Because I got my degree in tech also from Bowling Green State University, and I remember I got my degree like during the .com craze, and I don't even remember the word cybersecurity. Maybe IT security, but yeah, never cybersecurity. So do you remember when you like first heard that term?
You know, I really don't, and it's funny. I think maybe I take it for granted because I've just been in the industry for so long that the term doesn't really matter. You know, it's just what I do, and you can call it what you want. And I know terms and phrases and acronyms keep being repurposed as well.
Oh, yeah.
Even just the term hacker was, you know, originally not so derogatory and eventually became associated with negative activities or nefarious activities. And I don't know, cyber itself is, you know, not a security-related term. Cyber is just computer, and now it's often we'll hear just the term cyber, and people are referring to cybersecurity. And I don't know when it really became a thing. Now I've got to look it up, though.
I've had some people ask me, like, when did this term come out? I don't know, maybe late 90s, early 2000s, you know, I don't know. But anyway, cool. So tell us more about the company you work for right now, like Atlantic Data Security. Tell us how I got started. I mean, did you have a lending hand in building the company?
We're basically a cybersecurity consultancy. We started, in depending on how we look at it, we've been in business 30 years, and that goes back to individuals and our founders and our owners that, you know, have been in this space that long since cybersecurity and you know, firewalls. And just, again, from my perspective, I think the modern firewall was invented roughly 30 years ago. And it's not as exciting and sexy as it used to be because it's 30 years old. They continue to evolve. But prior to that, you know, and prior to the Internet, security was really, or cybersecurity as we know it today, was probably just antivirus. You know, so there was, it was really the evolution and the adoption of the Internet that led to the modern needs of cybersecurity, and that was 30 years ago, and many of our folks were in the space then with you know, in different places with different companies that ultimately led to the foundation of what we are today. But for me, it was a little over 20 years ago that I started working for a company called Netanium that we kind of spun up to be a spin-off of another company that our founder was working for. And it was to handle things that they didn't want, that they didn't have interest in, you know, new aspects of security, of network security, as we called it at the time. And I was the only employee. He owned it, so I'm not technically the owner, founder in that sense. But it was really just exciting work and good stuff to do and stuff I had a handle on. And when you're small like that, you do a lot of things, wear a lot of hats. And I'm doing the engineering and the technical work, but doing marketing and every other little thing that's needed in our internal IT. And we grew slowly and gradually but safely over the decades. And then all that time, we knew other people in our area and geographically especially that were similar companies, arguably competitors. But I don't like competition, which is why I don't love the sales game. I'd rather just get along and help people. And we had working relationships with a lot of these companies. And some of the individuals we knew in another competitive company, we eventually got together. And it was around 6 years ago, we ended up merging those companies to form what is now Atlantic Data Security. And they were Atlantic Data already. We had slightly different areas of focus. And when we got together and merged to make what we are, it was synergy and not overlap. We didn't eliminate positions. We started hiring and growing. And it was a match made in heaven. And it continued to just grow us to what we are now and continuing to grow, but in very smart ways and doing things that 20 years ago I never envisioned, I think, that we'd be doing today.
Well, what are some of your offerings that you sell to your clients, and what's like your sweet spot? Like, who's your target market? Small, medium size, Fortune 500, government? Who do you work with the best, and who's the most receptive to your services?
That's also a really good question and tough for me to answer. And again, not being, by nature, I'm not a sales guy. I'm an engineer. I look at things technically. I think we don't differentiate or we don't discriminate with who we work with. We have in our current client list companies ranging from small to enterprise, private to government, different sectors, education, healthcare, manufacturing, you name it. We do work with utilities and various companies. And I find that very interesting. We get to work with so many different types and sizes of organizations that we get to see a lot and learn a lot and be exposed to a lot. And it keeps us on our toes. And as we've grown, some people specialize more. Some of our people specialize more, know more about certain industries and work differently with, different companies and organizations. But we really do run the gamut. And our services have evolved from that as well. Whereas, initially we were a little bit of a different type of a company focused more on resale and reselling, and that's the term VAR is used to indicate value-added reseller. And I've always, I don't want to say hated the term, but I've hated how that term, like we said earlier, terms change in meaning. And over the years, that's been often abbreviated to just reseller, which to me as an engineer, as someone technically minded and prefers to solve problems, reselling is not interesting and sexy and fun and challenging. It's here's a price and a part and a product, and let me just move that from here to there. Whereas the other part of VAR, the rest of the initialism, the value-added reseller, the VA is much more interesting to me, adding value and finding ways to not just sell a product, but make sure it's working. Make sure you're getting, the purchaser is getting value out of that product and actually accomplishing the goals they purchased the product for. And I think that's often lost in reselling. It's just about moving boxes or moving licenses.
Well, how do you define value? Like, how explain that to somebody in the cyber world?
Well, for me, it starts before you've even made the sale. I think there's a very important aspect to make sure that you're buying the right thing. And sometimes that in and of itself can be the value added, where if somebody comes and says, hey, I want to buy X, we can say, sure, here's a price, here's how much X costs. Or we can say, all right, why? I want to make sure that you really need X and you don't need Y or Z, because I want you to be happy with it in the end. And that's sometimes a tough thing to do, because there are certain customers or clients that come in knowing they've done their research and they just want what they're asking for. And that's fine. We're happy to do that. And we do a lot of that. A lot of our clients are very educated shoppers and come in knowing what they need. so that pre-sale value isn't as necessary. But for some, that's essential. And I have actually, oddly enough, I've talked people out of buying something that they came to us for. Because when we peeled back what they actually needed, what they were asking for, wasn't going to deliver what they thought. And whether that was that they were misled or just had a misunderstanding or didn't understand that that cool thing they saw that somebody convinced them was really neat wouldn't really work in their environment because of other issues or other things they have in place or don't have in place, and it wasn't really the right fit. So I'm happy to talk them out of it if ultimately it's not going to deliver what they thought and, you know, save their money and spend it wiser elsewhere. But then after the sale is the more common, I think, view of where value can be added, and that's through services. And the traditional simple ways through implementation and taking whatever that product is and helping make sure that you get it off the ground, you get it installed properly, get it, you know, working properly. And then sometimes in an ongoing continuous basis, continue to validate it, verify it, make sure that you're getting value. And you know, care and feeding is a thing. And we like to be able to help now, and that's one of those areas that we've grown into in all of those aspects, including the continuous care and feeding.
Excellent. Now, at the beginning of the show, I kind of elaborated on your title. It sounds like you have three different hats that you wear, evangelist, educator, and architect. Tell us about that. Tell us about those roles and how they all kind of come together.
Well, I think it goes back to, again, when I started the former company, that one of the ones that merged. When you're small, you wear a lot of hats and you fill a lot of different roles. You do what's needed. And I just enjoy that. I enjoy being able to bounce. As I said, though, I'm an engineer. I'm left-brained, logic-minded. That's how I think, and you can't beat that out of me. But I also like to try, whether it's deliberate or not, try and exercise the right side of my brain with creativity and doing other things. And sometimes they clash, but other times they come together to help me be able to fill other roles and do other things as necessary. And one of those was teaching. It was a few years after I started in cybersecurity, a couple of years, that we were doing a lot of teaching for one of the vendors we worked with closely. And I wasn't the one doing it initially, but the demand was so high, we had such a long wait list that the decision was made, hey, it would be helpful if Eric got trained up to help teach this product. And I took to it, and I enjoyed it and have been doing it ever since. Not full-time, but occasionally when we have the need and the demand there, I enjoy it. And I think almost selfishly, I enjoy teaching because it is a great opportunity for me to learn. I get exposed to such a wide variety of students, and their questions drive me, because I'm very upfront with students at the start of a class, and I say, my favorite questions are the ones that I can't answer, and I'm more than happy to tell you I don't know the answer. I'm not going to stand in front of you and claim I know everything. The person who does is a liar. You can't know it all anymore. I might know a lot, but I enjoy those questions that I don't know the answer for, because I'm going to find an answer, and in doing so, I'm going to learn with you, and I will convey it to you, whether it's, you know, after class, during class, or, you know, in the next couple of days after the class. So I find it a great opportunity for me to learn from their experiences, learn from their questions. So that's one of those kind of subtitles, one of those pieces of my multifaceted role that I'm not eager to give up. So I continue to do it, but I also find that kind of manifests itself into other things that I do. I find that I'm always trying to help spread knowledge, even through things like this, through podcasts or webinars or other presentations I end up doing as part of that evangelist role, where I'm just trying to convey information to those who want it about cybersecurity and help further the concept of security and again, kind of balancing the logic-minded nerd and the wanting to be somewhat creative speaker and presenter and teacher. And then the other piece of the title is often that I work with clients to help solve the problems, because that's that piece of me that really does want to be a problem solver and say, what is it that you need? What is it that's troubling you or challenging you? And let's work together to architect the right solution. Okay. So I find it interesting to be able to do different things like that and help in various ways. So I'm reluctant to have one of those titles be stuck on me without the others being addressed.
Excellent. Are you like an adjunct professor at any college or university?
No, I'm not. No, I don't have many official titles.
Have you thought of becoming one maybe?
The idea's been floated, but I'm busy enough as it is. Maybe someday. I'm not opposed to it. I'm not opposed to many things. I'm open to different ideas, but I've never, honestly, it's never been presented to me in a way that I really even can claim to know that much about what it would entail. So it's you know, I'll have to look that up too. It has been asked briefly of me, but not in any detail.
Well, it sounds like you'd be very well qualified to teach courses, you know. But that's just my opinion, my humble opinion. What are some of the major challenges? I mean, we can talk all day long about successes, but what about some of the major challenges that you've had in your when you try to teach, customers, clients, people? What are some of the biggest hurdles you face, and how have you resolved them, or if you've been able to resolve them?
That opens up a whole different avenue, and there's in thinking of that question, which again I love these questions. That one could go down a whole bunch of different avenues, because I think from a technical standpoint, there are always technical challenges, and there's usually, if not always, technical solutions. Some smart creative people will create a product, whether it's software, hardware, usually a combination, to address that technical challenge, and they continue to get better and better. And then once they tackle something, then the challenge changes. The threat landscape, the bad guys find a new way to do what they're doing, and we have to pivot the solutions as well. So it's constantly evolving. But I think the technology, and I'm an optimist, but I'm also a realist, and I think the technology is fairly well in hand, because that's such a good business, and it's so well, I'll say, funded, and yet there's always room for improvement. For me personally, I think what I've seen, and part of this is through the exposure of having different roles and working in different capacities with so many different students and clients and even my colleagues, that there's this other side where we have, again, that left side and right side of a brain that think differently, and so many people are one or the other, that there's that human element and that applying of technology to the human element and the harder to define, less logical challenges. I guess another way I could say it is ones and zeros are always ones and zeros. If everything were based on ones and zeros, we could solve problems definitively. But when things are more analog and people, whether it's because of their stubbornness or corporate politics or other things, become a hindrance in security, that's the challenge that I find myself being drawn to try and to solve. And that, again, it's a whole wide area that I don't think about a lot, but occasionally I do. And kind of why it's steering me in that direction is sort of a non-answer. Go ahead, sorry.
The biggest challenge I find is I also have a division that sells, that we offer cyber services. We are VARs for a bunch of different vendors. And my partner and I, we have a hard time trying to, actually to make small business owners understand the need for cybersecurity. And it's really, it's in every business owner, whether how large or how small. I mean, the mind says, well, if we've never been hit, we won't be hit. We will never be hit. But that's still wrong, So, we've tried things like that. Yeah. So that's been our biggest drawback right now. Excuse me, but
the perception that we're too small to be interesting. Who would want to attack us? We're nobody. But that doesn't matter.
Hackers and go, the low hanging fruit first. But so that's kind of what we've been doing and everything. So it's been a challenge, but I think we're getting better at it. So anyway.
I think, over time it does continue to improve. The more media covers, what is happening out there, people, can't keep their head in the sand forever. They are slowly coming out and realizing, yes, everyone has to pay at least some attention to cybersecurity, how much and you know, how you deal with it is definitely going to vary, but it's a reality for everybody.
Yeah. Well, now, kind of segueing back to your company, ADS, Atlantic Data Security, what kind of, without giving out any confidential information, what kind of, like, expansion plans do you have in the future? Do you plan to expand it more globally, like maybe get more offices overseas or just get bigger clients? Or what are your plans for that?
That might be a question for others that are steering the company, for our principal owners. But I'll give you my best guess and my hope. And my hope is that we just continue to focus on quality of what we're doing rather than trying to take over the world. I think when you set your sights on lofty ambitions of we want to have offices in, you know, 6 continents, that's great. But if you're going to do so and dilute your services and your capability and your quality in the process, what's the real end? You know, by the time you get there, your reputation is gone. And I would rather we focus on what we do well and continue to do it well. And that's one of the things we've always managed to maintain is if we can't do it well, we'll find a partner or just decline, because we're not willing to risk our reputation on saying, yeah, we'll take a money grab and then fail miserably. And I think that's very short-sighted. There are companies that will do that to turn a quick profit. But that's not worth it to us. I think philosophically we've managed to be a long-term vision company where we just want to keep going well, you know, growing as it makes sense to grow, growing organically and not over-investing or over-committing or anything, and instead just continuing to deliver what we deliver at a high level. And that has led to growth. It has led to expansion. It has led to us taking on new lines of business that we didn't set out for, but we found ourselves doing because clients that trusted us were asking us to take things on, and we found ways to do it well, and then had these realizations a couple of times that, wow, we're doing this new thing, like our MSSP practice, that we didn't set out to be an MSSP and get in, you know, get investors and build out an infrastructure for it. We had done it over time for existing clients, and then realized when somebody else asked us for it, we said, wow, yeah, we are doing that. We can do that. We can compete with companies that we didn't, you know, put ourselves on a chart with. And that little aha moment led us to start marketing that and expanding it more deliberately. But I like that idea of just being able to continue to expand and find areas that we can be trusted in, that we can do well and grow them. And it's, again, someone else might say, yeah, we want to spread across the country and into other countries. And if that happens, that's great. But I would personally want to make sure we're maintaining the quality as we do so. And I don't think that's, you know, impossible. I think it's very possible and probably likely.
Okay, excellent. Well, I, this part of the show now, I kind of want to get your ideas and thoughts about some of the trends in cyber, some of the things that are happening. And I think one of the things that come to top of mind is artificial intelligence, machine learning, blah, blah, blah. The company I work for right now, they're making a big push into AI, as I was telling you before the show. And I've learned a lot about AI, you know, through my full-time job. I've written a bunch of white papers on generative AI, natural language processing, a digital person. I mean, it's mind-blowing how things are going. What are your thoughts on AI, and does ADS make use of it?
Oh, wow. It's another one of those loaded topics. We could do a whole podcast and talk for hours on AI. In fact, we did an informative webinar for our clients a bunch of months ago. Actually, I think it was for anyone. And I've talked more about just kind of clearing the air as to what AI is, because I find it's one of those terms, again, it's been overused and misused by the media and by others, and it's kind of lost all meaning. It means too many things that some are correct and some aren't. Often when people are talking about AI, they really mean machine learning. You know, that's what they're actually talking about, which is a piece of AI. And again, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole with you, but AI is a very broad topic with a lot of very interesting topics and some that aren't so interesting. But do we use it? Yeah. The vendors we work with use it heavily. You know, it's being used by the bad guys, so the good guys have to use it too. And I think that's often the way things work. Like generative AI specifically, one aspect of AI that involves, again, machine learning and you know, big data and other pieces to build out what we now know of as generative AI, that was used simply, you know, early on to improve the quality of spam and phishing. Let's fix the language issues that often made a phishing email stand out, and let someone who doesn't use whatever language natively craft a better email that's more believable. And then as that was used for bad, then we have to figure out, okay, how can we use this same tool for good? And I think very often it's used, you know, for the negative first, and then we have to figure out how to leverage it for the positive. And the other example I've used in that in discussions in the past is how students were using it early on. I think that was, late 2022, when ChatGPT went public and was used by students to write their papers for them. And it was very hard to combat until then, within a couple of weeks, there were ways for faculty and staff and teachers and professors to use the same tools to identify content that was generated by ChatGPT. So there's often a reactive piece there, but there's so much involved in AI. I think it's very interesting, very intriguing where it's going to go. There's no avoiding it. We have to embrace it. But within ADS, we're always looking for ways to use it. And yet I think we're using it through some of the products we use and some of the methods we use to help identify threats and prevent threats for our clients. The other aspects, I'm reluctant when it comes to the creative side of things and you know, writing a blog. I don't want to have an AI write content for me. I'd rather do that myself. and yet I'm not going to say that we don't have other people doing that, you know, clients, and I hear it all the time. I think that's there's another whole aspect to that how is that leading to security issues for companies and organizations that there's some very specific examples where it's been a problem as opposed to just intellectual property and the speed at which things can get done.
Well, we should have another podcast just on AI. How about that? But I've got some views on it too. As a writer, I've written books, so forth. But I've never used ChatGPT, and I don't intend to, because I think if a person wants to write something, they've got two things: they've got their own human brain, and they've got Google to get resources. And my dad was actually a professor at Purdue in neurobiology. He was a spinal cord regeneration researcher. And right before he died of a heart attack, he found a new way how to make the transplant cells live longer using amniotic fluid. So we've had we used to have discussions about human brain and all that. And he said, we'll never understand the human brain, maybe up to 0.05%. It's something that will never be understood. And so my views on AI in general are, we're in a bubble right now, like the .com thing. I mean, NVIDIA stock, skyrocketing, other, chip manufacturers, that make the data centers. It's going to burst one day, but AI is going to be around. And will it replace humans? No. It's going to be used for augmentation and some automation. I don't think it's going to be the end all or the all. It's not going to it will define society from a social perspective, but it won't, be the curse of society. It just depends on how we all make it. And I've got – go ahead.
No, I agree with you. You see these bubbles, and we saw it with, cryptocurrency you name a cool technical thing, it gets really big for a little while. The media loves covering it because it's new and interesting. Wall Street ends up seeing a major impact from it, and then it all settles down. And it's not gone. Cryptocurrency still exists. Bitcoin still exists. But nobody is as interested as they were when it was at its peak of volatility. And I think that's as AI settles in and we become accustomed to it. Yes, it's here. Yes, it's doing things and it's unavoidable, but it's not as exciting anymore because now it's commonplace and, we just adjust to it. And yet there's always somebody who's going to be pushing the envelope and hopefully, on the good side as much as on the bad side and using it for the right reasons as much as for the wrong reasons.
Well, another question I want to ask you is that, we've seen talk recently. In fact, the director of the FBI, I can't remember his name, he was in Congress last week testifying about, you know, I mean, I'm not going to get political here, but Chinese hackers and the attack on critical infrastructure. So that's another big topic, you know, that's coming about. In fact, one of the reports said that the Chinese hackers have been in our critical infrastructure for, you know, over 5 years, and we knew nothing about it.
Oh, longer than that, I would think, yeah. Yeah.
You know, what are your thoughts on this critical infrastructure issue? I mean, I think we're not going to see another 9/11 style attack, you know, planes crashing the buildings, but what I can foresee happening, and I hope it does not happen, is that, you know, there could be, like, you know, multiple attacks in large cities, you know, where they shut the water down, the electric grid. And we've seen signs of that, you know, like with Colonial Gas Pipeline, someone in Florida last year, a hacker tried to poison the water supply system, and some beef processor, I think, was hacked into a contaminated meat supply or something, I don't know. But what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, we're not ourselves, but we're working with our clients that are a part of that. Like I mentioned earlier, we work with some utilities and a lot of other organizations that do work either as part of or work with critical infrastructure, and they're all very aware, you know, and we've got engineers that have, you know, maintain the certifications to be able to help them and understand the sensitivity and the criticality. And when you're going to certain places, you don't expect to have your phone with you. You know, there is a lot of thought put into it, and we are part of it to a degree, but we're not trying to solve the problem for, you know, the country. We're trying to do our part, you know, stay in our lane as well. But we're aware of it, and it is a scary thing. And I understand and I know that critical infrastructure is being scrutinized. There are certain requirements. We talk about regulations and compliance all the time. And I know, again, I'm an optimist, but I'm a realist, and I know that there is a lot being done to try and make sure that we're in okay shape, but it is scary because it's arguably a much easier way to wreak havoc than with physical means, like, you know, bombs and missiles. Those are, you know, we've got our head around those. We've had our head around those for decades, if not a century of, you know, Cold War and everything in the middle of that. That's still a threat, but it's one that people understand. And this other threat, you go back to Stuxnet and other things that have already physically manifest through electronic means and digital means, we know that it can cause physical harm, either directly or indirectly, like things you mentioned. If we just shut off water or shut off gas or shut off electricity or any other utilities, there will be, you know, catastrophic consequences. There will be death and health issues and panic and financial impact. And it is definitely scary. And it's the new warfare. It's the new battlefront. As much as we do see, even currently, physical wars going on, even behind the scenes within those, there is digital warfare. And some of that is not even directly harming, but even just influence in the media and propaganda. We've seen for years now that it's being used to turn people's opinions and shape things. And that's where some of us, well, I'm an optimist, I also don't trust what I read and what I see in the media because there's always a spin to it. There's always an angle and there's always a counterpoint. So you have to really be careful what you believe and what you see. And I fear that might almost be the bigger impact of digital warfare right now is just opinions and people's moods.
Another one, the topic I kind of want to get your thoughts on are the Internet of Things. Now, that's a topic that at my workplace, too, that's starting to come up with, you know, the 5G wireless stuff that they're working on and AI. I'm, to be honest, Eric, I'm in cyber, but I hate technology. I know it sounds like a paradox, but I like on my cell phone, I don't have any mobile apps except for my email and maybe a couple of, like, you know, dual-factor authentication apps from Salesforce, Microsoft, you know, what have you. I drive an old-fashioned car. It's a 2003 Civic, and that darn thing still works, hopefully. You know, even in the cold weather, it still starts, which really surprised me. But I just don't get into, like, all this interconnectivity. It's scary, you know, like having a smart home, smart kitchen, smart refrigerator. Smart whatever, you know, you clap your hands, your TV turns on. Do you have a smart home or smart car? Like, what are your thoughts on the IoT?
Oh, gee. I don't want to tell you as I look around my desk how many individual, I can't even count how many individual devices I have with screens on them. It's I'm the other way. I'm a tech nerd. I'm a gadget hound. I love cool stuff, but I like to think at least I understand the threats and what's going on enough that I'm cautious with it. And there's, if you're cautious and confident that you understand the differences, you can keep a separation between devices and things and servers and drives and computers that have data and things you care about and things that you don't, like things you're playing with or toys, and there are ways to keep those separate. Many don't. I think that's the general problem is most of the population doesn't understand the difference, and they'll hook, you know, their computer and their kids' computer and their game consoles up to the same wireless, and then they'll buy the cheapest possible smart light bulb and connect that to the same wireless, and that device, knowingly or not, is connecting out over the internet to some service provider somewhere in some country that you may or may not want it to, but that's what it does. And then every time you turn that light on or off with your voice or with some other switch or with an app, you're communicating to wherever that is. And in its simplest, that could all just be shut off someday. You know, if all of the device, if, and I don't want to wish this, let's make up a country, you know, what's some fictional country that presumably if we had, you know, Antarctica was an enemy of ours, and the Antarctic army had, you know, sold us millions of devices, smart devices that all phone home to Antarctica to turn our lights on and off. All they have to do is shut off that service, and now nobody in the country can turn their lights on, and people just be all bent out of shape. It's we're very subjected to the, you know, home of those smart devices, and yet there's a better way to do it. There are ways to build a smart home that don't need the internet, and that alone is, you know, one of the things I'd love to see. But the cheap way, the easy way, the way that everyone finds on Amazon are devices that connect to Wi-Fi, and they promote, you know, no hub needed, like it's a good thing. And every time I see that, I think, oh, that's bad. I have a hub. My devices connect to a device in my home that controls them, not just to the internet. And that's, you know, if you're aware of that and you're doing it the right way, it doesn't have to be scary, but I know that's not the majority out there. So it is definitely a scary thing.
Just two more topics I want to get your thoughts on. Next one's about COVID-19. Now, you know, that's now, I would say it's distant memory. I mean, I've had some friends that have really gotten sick, and you know, after all the vaccines, they still keep getting sick. Back in 2019, when I first heard about it, I thought it was going to stay in China. But, you know, COVID really changed the world upside down, God knows how many times, especially this country. How did you guys react to COVID, and how did it impact, like, your remote workforce or working on prem or hybrid? And what are your thoughts on all that?
Well, for us, as Atlantic Data Security, the company itself, it didn't really affect us directly that much. I think there were many of us were working remotely anyway. We have expanded our geography in ways that don't require us to be in a physical office. Many of us still prefer to. So there was an immediate change where, all right, let's make sure everyone's working remotely. It changed our client interactions and our work for customer-facing stuff where we were not going on site to work with clients, and they were trying to deal with how to facilitate that. I think the bigger issue is in the industry, well, in society around the world, was organizations that weren't set up for mobile work to have to shift and allow that. And it was definitely a very noticeable change in our industry in particular, and just in IT in general, where every organization that could was trying to now find ways to enable work from home or remote work. And it was stressing their existing solutions, which maybe were being used by a small percentage of their workforce before that, and now they had to scale it out, and their infrastructure wasn't built for it, wasn't scaled for it, couldn't handle the load, so they're struggling to find ways to increase the capacity. Or other organizations just finding ways to very quickly implement a solution that they just didn't have at all before. And we saw that across the industry, and there was an immediate interest in enabling remote work for every industry that could, you know, are those that need physical hands on site, like, you know, working in a factory and so forth. But there was definitely a big shift towards that, and I think a lot of the cybersecurity industry and just the tech industry rose to that, whether it was for good intentions of trying to solve the problem or trying to make a cash grab of, hey, there's this opportunity now, so let's introduce products to help with that and try and capitalize on it. But it definitely changed this industry significantly, and it maybe it was just helped ramp it up into modern times, kind of force the hand, but it definitely changed a lot of things. And yet, for some of us, it didn't change much. I had been teaching some of my classes online already, so it was kind of funny. I already had the equipment, you know, multiple screens, camera, microphone to be able to shift, so I was okay, but then others are struggling to try and find webcams and microphones that had all been sold out. There were all kinds of interesting things. We could do a whole podcast on the ramifications of that as well. But
we can do another one on that. But
sorry?
Yeah, I remember the big issues was, you know, the companies didn't have, like, their, you know, their disaster recovery and response plans in place. So because of that, they didn't, you know, dispatch enough company-issued devices for employees. And they're using their devices. There were threats there, and then the intermeshing of the home and corporate networks. I remember, I think the one thing.
Or their DR plans were other physical facilities. Like, okay, if something happens to our primary office, you go work in this office. Well, that isn't going to work in this case. You need to be able to work from home. And not everyone had that in their plans, like you said, yeah.
And I remember the Zoom bombing pretty well, too. I never got Zoom bombed before. I remember.
That all came down to people adopting Zoom that didn't really know how and didn't know how to secure it, and they learned quickly, sometimes the hard way.
Well, COVID's going to be around. I mean, it's kind of like the flu. It's kind of now in the back burner now. But anyway,
another one of those bubbles. You know, it was big for a while, takes over the news cycle for in this case years. But you know, then it settles. It doesn't go away, but you learn to live with it. And
yeah, exactly. Well, the last thing I want to get your thoughts on is another topic. In fact, I'll be launching another company here in the next few months. It's about cyberbullying and cyber. And my company will be offering cyberbullying consulting services. So in that regard, I've created a repository.
Oh, wow.
I've written a bunch of newsletters. I've got someone ghostwriting blogs for me. You know, talking about COVID, you know, that's when, you know, a lot of companies, you know, like Google, Meta, I mean, they hired a ton of people. But now with all the, you know, with COVID now gone and everything, you know, we keep seeing all these layoffs. And a lot of these layoffs have hit those departments where they kept an eye on, you know, like, you know, black cyberbullying, you know, misinformation and all that.
Fake
now
news.
That's all gone. And now today, I mean, how do you know what's real, what's not real? And there's cyberbullying, you know, deep fakes. And what are your thoughts on all that? I know it's a broad-based question, and we probably have another podcast on that. Hey, three podcasts down the road here for you. But, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
That's a good one, and it's something I haven't honestly thought about much, mostly because my youngest is now 19, and you know, I'm a little bit past that stage where I'm immediately affected by, you know, children cyberbullying, but I know it's an awful thing, and it exists out there, and I think it's potentially still going to get worse before it gets better. So I'd love to hear more about what you're doing and what your plans are. But it's definitely a scary thing. It's awful. You still hear about it and see about it, and it's even portrayed in the media and in Hollywood. So I'm not saying I'm not sensitive to it, but I don't think about it as much. And yet social networking continues to just increase. And I don't know. It might be one of those things, and maybe I'm just thinking out loud here, but maybe this is one of those areas where a little bit more accountability through regulation and governance needs to be implemented. And I say that because I've had some great conversations with others in the industry around regulation and compliance that I think there's potentially an opportunity here to shift our perception of it and how we accept it as not just a necessary evil, but a necessary maturization of our approach to security and to these issues and to cyberbullying. It's not necessarily about censorship and restriction and handcuffing me and telling me how to run my company. Sometimes it's about allowing us all to play together properly. And if you'll permit me an analogy, I love using analogies. One that I've used here is look at another industry. Look at the transportation industry. And how incredibly regulated and restricted it is. Just here in the U.S. with cars, if you want to drive a car on a public road, you need not only a driver's license, which is in theory proof that you've taken classes or you've proven that you know how to drive, that you can see adequately, that you know the rules of the road and you've agreed to it. You need a car that has been inspected and in most states that is guaranteed to be safe enough. You need registration and insurance in many states that prove yes. And we accept it. We don't always like it, but we accept that that's what I need to do to be able to drive to the restaurant. And the reason we have to do that isn't so much to protect me. My insurance is more to, and in many states, you don't have to have insurance for yourself. You have to have insurance to cover the damage or injury you caused to somebody else. And it's the same thing with the inspection on your car. It's to prove that the car isn't going to injure somebody else. Because what you do to yourself, I don't care. But I don't want you to injure me. And that's kind of this concept of if everyone were abiding by the same rules, it's about protecting each other. And yet the big difference is driving a car on public roads, somebody owns the roads, and it's the state or local or federal government owns and maintains those roads. So it's not a right to drive on those roads. It's a privilege. And yet the internet, I think, we all see it as a right. And that's where I have a hard time making the comparison, because it kind of has to be. It's essential. There are things that you could not do the way we are today, you know, until we have a major issue and have to start going back to paper, that you need it. And you can't take it away. You can't restrict someone. But I like to think maybe through some more diligent standards, such as social media, you know, and who can get on. Do you have to prove who you are to be able to make posts? You know, the ability to create a fake account and pretend to be, you know, someone who you aren't is bad. There's no accountability because of an anonymity. And I don't want over-regulation. I don't want, deep state monitoring and Big Brother. But anonymity is a little bit too easy to achieve. And that makes things like cyberbullying a little bit too easy to get away with as well.
Hey, no, I got to
Sorry, I kind of went a bunch of different directions there. me thinking.
That brings me to we were on LinkedIn. I connected with you, but about a month ago, my LinkedIn profile got hacked into, and somebody put a different picture profile. And so I've been trying to create a new LinkedIn account, you know, and I just can't create, so I just gave up on it for a while. I said, enough. So anyway, but I want to ask you for your thoughts on this one. We'll save it for a different podcast. But that brings up another issue. You talked about, like, having federal standards and all that for cyberbullying. The data privacy laws and everything, you know, each state's kind of coming up with its own thing. So I'm kind of an advocate for, like, a Department of Cybersecurity, like the Department of Homeland Security, where everything's all standardized. But we'll keep that for a different conversation, a different podcast. Look, I'll let you kind of chew on that one.
I'll just say I agree. I think here in the U.S. we value our freedom, and I'm a patriot. I love it. I'm a fan of all of it. But I see certain things happen in other areas, like in the EU, where they start enacting, and this is across multiple countries working together, and in many ways they're more progressive than we are in coming up with legislation that says someone's responsible for that data. And it forces the hand, and it forces a little bit more advancement. Here in the U.S., we're so competitive and yet free that sometimes it takes longer. There's more red tape to get things done. Sorry, again, I went on a bit of a tangent there. But
no, we'll keep that. How about for a fourth podcast? I've got some ideas now for a fourth podcast. Anyway, well, as we wrap up our show, Eric, what are your thoughts on the cyber threat landscape as, you know, we venture on further into 2024 of what do you think is going to be the biggest threat vector, and, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it keeps us employed, for one, some of us. You know, it's as much as I would love to see the threats just go away and the world become simpler, it's not going to happen. So it's the threat landscape is what drives the solution landscape, and it will continue to. And that's solutions that are both products and services and in combination usually to help deal with the threats. And it will continue to evolve. If I could predict where it was going to go, I'd be rich, or I would soon be rich. There's plenty of that's being hedged towards what's going to be the next big thing. We know AI is going to be a part of it, but it's not AI itself. It's how AI will be leveraged to do new things, you know, new nefarious, new evil things to change the threat landscape or to evolve it, expand the threat landscape. I think things like you mentioned, state-sponsored, you know, warfare is one of the scarier aspects, and that's definitely a huge piece. But there's little that we can do as individuals or even as companies to combat that. So we're dealing more with the commercial and personal threats. And, you know, it's staying on top of things. Stay well-educated, well-informed, be open to new ideas. And really, you can't get too set in your ways, because the second you think you have it all covered, it's going to change on you. And it's really a matter of staying informed and aware and being ready to pivot and adapt as the landscape changes underneath us.
Okay, excellent. Well, Eric, we thank you for your time this evening. You shared a lot of good insights into these hot-button topics. And as I said, I've got four podcasts in mind, so hopefully we can get you back here in the near future again.
Sure, I'd love to.
Oh, yeah, what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you in case they have questions or they want to know more about your services? What's the best way someone can get a hold of you?
Well, you can – a couple of ways. LinkedIn is always a great way to find me. And if you search for Eric Anderson, Atlantic Data Security, that's one way. My short name on LinkedIn is E-A-N-D-E-R. If you do LinkedIn, I think /IN/EAnder, that'll find me. Or eric@atlanticdatasecurity.com. Yeah, good old-fashioned email.
Okay, excellent. Well, we thank you for your time, Eric, and we look forward to having you again here in the near future.
Oh, thank you. Be happy to come back.
Take care. Have a good evening.
You too.